Welcome to Zero Point Radio. Every second Saturday from 4 to 6 Eastern Time, or 1 to 3 Pacific Time, we have a two-hour radio spot thanks to BBS Radio. My name is Christopher Holmes, and I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca. My work deals with the scientific and scholarly study of mystical and esoteric teachings and relating them to modern psychology and science. In addition, we range across a wide range of issues and deal with the contemporary situation of humanity and the problems facing us in this critical time in human history. My co-host is James Moffitt from, I'm in Ottawa, Ontario, or just outside of Ottawa, and my co-host James Moffitt is in Toronto. Hi, Jim, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Okay. I don't know if we had anything to pick up on, Jim, that,
We talked last week about Steven Weinberg's article, which appeared in the New York Review of Books Without God, and we discussed that in terms of your work and the problem of God's contracting universe, which was based on Carl Sagan's work. I was really struck in reading the article just how essentially 30 years later, Weinberg's article really just recapitulates what Carl Sagan wrote and broke his brain and somewhat in some of his later work, but it essentially just reiterates the idea what people that I would call scientific fundamentalists propose that as science advances, there seems to be less and less for God to do, or what's sometimes called the God of the gaps, and what you've called the problem of God's contracting universe. Is it true that as science advances and provides explanations of phenomena in terms of material processes, that there's indeed less and less reason to believe in God, or less reason to invoke a God as a causal explanation, or any kind of spiritual reality? And on a certain level, I think this seems like a plausible proposal if you take things very superficially, but once you begin to look beyond that, you realize that this is really, like, as I say, this is based on what I would call a fundamentalist, scientific, materialist, reductionist perspective on the nature of things, which really is fundamentally mistaken and incomplete, very superficial, and when applied to spiritual matters is quite absurd and doesn't really provide a kind of meaningful discussion of the nature of spirit or the nature of spiritual reality. So it was interesting talking about that article last week because it just reaffirms to me that, as I say, 30 years later, these ideas that Carl Sagan articulated in his book Broke His Brain, and in particular one of his papers called A Sunday Sermon, are very much with us. And there seems to be a real spate of these books now that have come out with Richard Dawkins, the success of Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, and Sam Harris's The End of Faith, Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, Daniel Dennett's works, including Darwin's Dangerous Idea, and he's got another one which I can't recall the title of, about
the Science or Consciousness Explained.
No, not that one, but he does have that one, too, Consciousness Explained, which is without doubt one of the worst books I've ever tried to read. I couldn't read it. I found it.
No,
it's horrible. I find him peculiarly. He has this very strange high idea of his own intellect and his ability to explain things. And when you begin to look at his ideas, he just dismisses things. He doesn't really tackle them in any kind of meaningful fashion. And that to have the chutzpah to call a book Consciousness Explained, and then basically to present a book which is nothing more than psychophysics, right, Chris? I mean, it's essentially what in psychology is known as psychophysics. My recollection of the book is it essentially just dealt with perception, and it didn't really have anything to do with consciousness.
No, he never defined it.
He never defined it. He never addressed it. So it's terrible book. But anyway, there's this real, Michael Shermer has a couple of books too, Why People Believe Strange Things or Peculiar Things or something like that. And
yeah.
All these people are, as I say, and when they discuss these big issues about the nature of science and the nature of religion, it's odd, it's ironic that they seem to embody the same things that they criticize in fundamentalist religious believers, which is that they have these grossly oversimplified ideas of things and hold them up as being truth. And I think they misrepresent both religion by attacking these fundamentalists, but which I quite agree with them on in that sense. But they attack these fundamentalists, but then they conflate the fundamentalism with all religious beliefs and all religious aspirations and all religious experiences, which is completely ridiculous. And then they present science as necessarily representing scientific naturalism to them as materialism and as atheism and as based on a reductionist approach. And all of those are very... those are interpretations. Those are very strict interpretations of science. And
there are also so many enigmas and unexplained elements in all of the sciences.
The whole card that they say was, science is never complete and perfect in its explanation of things, and it's always reworking ideas, and it's always open to new ideas and everything. But they act as if they know what the unknown is, that they really gloss over, as you say, these profound enigmas and mysteries. I mean, the most basic two of them being, how does life arise and how does consciousness arise? And really, when you look at scientific explanations of these things, what you have is these educated guesses, but they really, when you really subject them to, I think, careful scrutiny, they don't explain either of these phenomena. There's something fundamentally wrong with the materialist model. And even modern physics in the 20th century has really established that there's a limit to the explanation of things in terms of material processes. So that was a really interesting to go back and discuss
the same issues, as you say, are still so contemporary.
Yeah, and I think
between science and religion, but it's a pseudo debate because they misrepresent science and they misrepresent what religion are.
Yeah,
and in a way, we need to look. You know, you can have a broader scientific method that includes study of the enigmas and unexplained phenomena, and you can have a esoteric religion, which is more science of the soul and science of consciousness.
Well,
and that's not considered. They only consider religious differences in terms of the exoteric side of religion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that Gurdjieff once said, which I think is so essential and is really missing in the great science versus religion debate, even in the more sophisticated discussions, I've been reading this book by Ian Barber, about science, when science meets religion, which is really excellent. And Barber's a theologian and a real scholar of modern science, and he presents all the different perspectives on the different points of interaction or separation between science and religion, because there are many different perspectives articulated by different people, and he discusses all of these within a typology he has. It's very interesting because it's a very, you know, when you really look at it, there are many, many different perspectives. But what strikes me most about his work is how there's some allusions to the mystical and esoteric perspective, but there's no development of that perspective and no application.
Well, there hasn't been very much.
No.
I mean, I would say that's what my work does,
it takes
the esoteric teachings and tries to relate them to ideas of modern science and physics.
Like, and
in two most important areas. One is like this whole idea that our essential I experience and human consciousness and life within the human being originates out of the heart, and that the heart is really a multidimensional thing that exists in ways into higher space dimensions. Like there's a spiritual heart and a metaphysical heart. It's not only a material organ. And that somehow the life principle inhabits the body through the mechanisms of the heart, and life and consciousness come into the body through the mechanisms of the heart and the blood flow. So it's a whole alternative model of what consciousness might be, and consciousness is light, and trying to understand consciousness in terms of quantum physics. So
yeah,
we try to look at the, what could be the scientific basis of mystical teachings about the heart and about consciousness.
Yeah, and what I think is really missing in so much of the of these discussions is this idea that that esoteric teachings provide a very radically different understanding of the nature of consciousness, which leads to a very radically different understanding of the nature of what it means to be human and what the nature of the universe is and what the potential interfaces between human consciousness and the existence of the universe provide. And what I was going to say earlier was one thing that Gurdjieff said that strikes me is unrecognized, which is so important about religion, is that he said religion consists of two parts. It consists of beliefs and doctrines and what is taught, but then there's also a practical aspect to it. There's the teaching of the instrumental aspect of religious teaching, and he said people differ radically in how they're able to practice the instrumental aspect, so that you have people in normal waking consciousness practice religions according to their types, and he calls them the three different types of the physical, emotional, and intellectual types. And then you have higher, more developed people, in his terminology, man number 4, 5, 6, and 7. And each of these people has a completely different practice and observation of religious teachings. And you can see that even through the intellectual study of religious teachings and of an esoteric perspective on religious teachings. And say somebody like Maurice Nicol, one of Gurdjieff and Uspensky's pupils, you read his interpretations of the Gospels, and I've never read anything which even remotely resembles his interpretation of what the Gospels are saying. And because he's basing it on that the Gospels, he's basing his interpretation on the idea that the Gospels are a teaching which is designed to awaken consciousness and being. And this is a very radically different idea than is generally put forth. I mean, there are many different interpretations of the Gospels, but again, this is related somehow to the idea of being and of developing and transforming one's self and consciousness, and these are issues that are never really addressed in any meaningful way in the discussions, and that's where your work I think is so important and so interesting. At the very least, an esoteric perspective, Chris, what it provides is that it challenges the assumptive framework underlying modern science and psychology. It calls into question every major assumption, and it brilliantly illuminates the nature of these assumptions. And so once you have this perspective, you see the possibility of understanding everything, time, space, I, thou,
yeah, yeah,
you know, God,
yeah,
spirit, soul, everything, you know, consciousness, matter, everything, meaning,
yeah,
every level of meaning is completely transformed by being introduced,
yeah,
to these teachings and studying them within oneself.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, we should move on, and I meant to suggest for next show, do you have a copy of Uspensky's book called Talks with the Devil?
I think I do, yes, I think I do.
I'd like to review that next,
yeah,
week.
Okay.
Yeah, so maybe we'll have that. It's really interesting.
Okay.
Aspects of that, and I think really contemporary.
I just wanted to alert you to something, too. I'm going to try to find this for you. I'm not sure why I got it, so it's going to be a bit of a challenge, but I'm going to try to find this for you before I come to Ottawa for Thanksgiving. There's a book by Gary Schwartz, who's a PhD in psychology, taught at Harvard, now teaches at the University of Arizona, I believe, called God Experiments, G.O.D. Experiments, which refers to guidance, organization, and design. And the subtitle is How Science is Discovering God in Everything, Including Us. Very interesting book. Like,
And
I think he doesn't develop materials, I would say, to the depth that you do, but I think what he's suggesting is very much congruent and, you know, with no way really contradicts contradicts the perspective that you're putting forward.
Yeah.
So I thought we might in a future session discuss that book too, because I think he's on to some very interesting things, and he raises some real interesting examples about just the overwhelming evidence that there is some sort of guiding, organizing, and designing the process. And you know, he like so many of us, he raises his own difficulties with the idea of, you know, the traditional idea of God that he was taught as a child, as some old guy with a white beard, you know, who sits around in his underwear all day keeping tabs on creation, and like his own resistance to that. But it's more akin to like Blavatsky's notion of God, or to the, you know, like an impersonal God, but an intelligence. So
I quote Schwartz in my writing on the Heart Doctrine, where he's reviewing Pearsall's book.
Oh, yeah, really?
He's the fellow who says, if the 20th century was the century of the brain, the 21st century will be the century of the heart.
Oh, is that the same Schwartz?
Yeah, that's the same Gary Schwartz, a biofeedback researcher and such, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we should move on, and I do have our guest, so I'll introduce our guest, which is Dr. Andrew Mulden. And Andrew is both a PhD psychologist in, I think, neuropsychology and biological psychology from the University of Ottawa. And then he went on to study medicine at McMaster, and became an MD, and then did a specialty in psychiatry. And Andrew, I will hear his story from himself, but he has become interested in the impact of vaccinations on children and adults, and has made some dramatic breakthroughs in this area in understanding the impact of vaccinations on people at a biological, neurological level. And he has become involved in awakening people to the dangers inherent in vaccinations. And then Andrew most recently has become involved in the Canadian Action Party, which is the only what I would call non-New World Psychiatric Disorder party in Canada. That is the only party not controlled by the corporate elite and serving the agendas of the elites. So anyway, Andrew is running under the CAP banner in the district of North Bay, Ontario, in the federal elections currently going on. So I'd like to range across a wide range of subject matters here and kind of open it up to Andrew as well as I may. Hi, Andrew. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Holmes. Thank you very much for having me on your show. And hello, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very fine. Thank you. Just a quick cap. Paul Broca was actually a neurologist at the turn of the century in the book you were describing earlier. And Paul Broca, along with his colleague Carl Wernick, were very, very effective early on in the early 1900s of demonstrating how certain functions in the human brain are localized to a specific area. And ironically, the knowledge that they sort of created and laid down as a foundation for us to localize function in the human brain is pretty much some of the core information that I initially relied upon to break down how vaccines, unfortunately, have been causing more harm than good, both before the mandatory vaccines and the same process we identify now that's causing damage to derail normal functions in the human brain is the same process by which polio caused paralysis, tetanus caused lockjaw, measles killed people, and smallpox killed people, including the 20 million that died after the Spanish flu in 1918. It's quite exciting, but it's also quite humbling to have the knowledge we now have, which is before the Federal Circuit Courts of the United States.
Wow, maybe we can step back for a little bit, Andrew.
Sure.
Once you became a doctor and then got into psychiatry, at what point in there did you start becoming alerted to the issues of vaccination?
Okay, that's a wonderful question, Chris. I guess for the listeners, it's best to recap very briefly my background training. I completed a bachelor's degree in biological psychology at Nipissing University in North Bay, graduating in 1990. Received the North Bay Nugget Psychology Honor Award, a core concentration average of 88%. Much of my undergraduate training was in biological psychology and the human brain. I went on to an Ontario graduate scholarship at Laurentian University in Sudbury and did a master's degree in child development, and specifically looking at how children and infants right up to their teen years into high school develop their processing of information skills with intelligence testing and some specialized tests that look at language development children. After that, I went on to a PhD in neuropsychology and clinical experimental psychology at University of Ottawa on a Natural Sciences Engineering and Research Council of Canada scholarship. Again, graduated there, top of the class. And there I was looking specifically at, again, in the whole adult population, how the brain functions and how we process information from psychology, and particular neuropsychology, which is a series of tests that we use to localize specific functions to the human brain using tests that we are basically paper and pencil tests. And then from there, I went on to complete my thesis in functional brain imaging at the University of Toronto for 3 years under the direction of a fairly well-renowned neurologist and a neuropsychologist at the Bakerest Hospital, which is the Rotman Research Institute, which is internationally renowned as the leading area for functional brain imaging and localizing functions of the human brain using high-tech technologies. And then
what would be the name of that instrumentation? Like it's...
Exactly. Sure. So during the PhD training, the tools I was using, considering I was surrounded by world experts in cognition, in fact, I'll say that after, world experts in cognition and how the brain processes information, the technology I was specifically working with during the PhD training was a fancy form of an electroencephalogram, which basically allows us to record the electrical activity of the human brain non-invasively at the surface of the scalp and to infer backwards where the various functions are being activated in the brain as we think, remember, and process and act. During that, I was an Ontario Mental Health Foundation scholar, and then even after that, rather than take up my ivory tower position of being Dr. Molden researcher, I went on to medical school at McMaster. Most people don't do that, but my motivation for all these years was primarily to get an understanding of what actually is happening to derail the body and the brain in situations of disease and disorder. And even though I was a national provincial scholar, top of the class, and had all these accolades and 27 scholarships for academic and research excellence, even after the PhD, I still didn't have the answers. So I realized I needed to go back to undergrad and learn some medicine, anatomy, and physiology and find out what we do know. Now, the interesting outcropping of that, it wasn't intentional, is that once you've studied all these issues of human disease and physiology and brain function and development and child development and from the multiple different angles that I have, eventually after the PhD and the MD, you get in a position where you now recognize what the physicians know and don't know, and sometimes they assume to be truths when in actuality you go back to the scientific literature, it's not entirely that way. So then I was then in a position after medical school with this broad eclectic training of knowing what the physicians know and don't know, and knowing what the PhDs know and don't know. But more importantly, I was then in a position to know what they both think the other guy knows, but I know now that they don't know. So it was very easy, to a certain extent, to step through the assumptions that we take after our clinical training and our medical training, and realize where our errors are being made. But that was the foundation. And then shortly after coming out of medical school, I was in a psychiatry residency at University of Ottawa. And interestingly enough, I did a placement for a couple months up in northern Ontario in North Bay, where I had actually grown up. And during that time in the area, it was when I first came across several patients and individuals and, frankly, some friends of family that really came back down to Paul Broca, the neurologist, because I saw very clearly training that I had opened my eyes to see things that were right before our very eyes. And unfortunately, physicians would not have this training because they study medicine. And the PhD psychologists wouldn't have this understanding because they don't study medicine. But putting it all together, immediately I saw in acute patients as well as people who've been injured by vaccines or become autistic or had other developmental disabilities that could be traced back to vaccination. And vaccine was a new thing for me to realize that may be causally related to causing human disease and disorders. It became very, very clear to me that all of a sudden, with that training, I could actually see before my very eyes hard, specific neurological damage in the here and now using the tests and tools that we actually are trained to use in neurology and in medicine, as well as in the training I'd have from all those 13 years of studies in areas that most of my physician colleagues would not have. Now, that doesn't make me smarter than the average bear. That doesn't make me brilliant in any way. It just is, by analogy, it gives you a perspective on a broader problem that you can see it with the background training that you have that most other individuals cannot. So you could
tell that somehow the vaccinations were causing mini strokes. Would you say cerebral mini strokes?
Exactly.
What was the mechanism you saw as causing this relationship?
Yeah. So it became the first clue. Again, this comes right back down to Paul Broca. Again, the very first clue was one of the first autistic patients I had seen. Now you have to keep in mind that I spent all of my life in academia studying these things, but I'd never had a chance to actually see the patients. I was book learned and self taught and university taught and research and academia by the best of the best, and graduated at the top of the classes I was in. I had the background knowledge to actually have an understanding of what might be going on, but until I actually saw it firsthand, it didn't really make much sense. So when I first came across the patients, not only in the hospital wards, but in the community, who were showing to me very clear signs, and this is very critical, and this comes back to Paul Broca. In medicine and in neurology, when a person loses their language functions, especially a child or an infant or even an adult, when they lose the ability to speak clearly, we call that productive speech, and this is Paul Broca's work. And then you go back to that, and you see that they remain intact for the ability to comprehend things spoken to them, or for that matter, in some instances, they can repeat things almost verbatim. We call that echolalia in medical parlance. Now, that whole process of not being able to get formed language, but being able to comprehend to a certain extent what's being said to you, and being able to repeat, sometimes almost verbatim, with enhanced repetition skills, is what we call in neurology a transcortical motorphagia. Fancy words meaning basically the derailment of function, not being able to speak, being able to repeat, and being able to comprehend. We know that in developmental neuropsychology, the only way that can be caused in the human brain, because its functions are for these different areas of repeat, speak, as well as comprehend, is laid out in the brain based on its small blood vessel distribution to these areas. So the only way you can create that pattern of behavioral symptoms in an individual is to mess around with a small blood supply to the human brain. So in January of 2001, it was sort of that sort of a proverbial aha moment, if you will, that sort of like led, wait a minute here, this can only be caused by blockage of the small blood vessels. But how could it that these children I have, who are now autistic, how could they possibly have the equivalent of microvascular strokes to the brain very early in life? That didn't make sense. But then when I got back to Ottawa after being in North Bay and went through the medical literature to what the bugs were doing, like measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, polio, in the era before we started putting these bugs into vaccines and mandating that everybody has to have them, lo and behold, sure enough, there it all was that these bugs, and using rubella or German measles as an example, were causing the equivalent of microvascular strokes in the brains of all the people receiving them. So that was just a, wait a minute here, now I've got 1 plus 1 equals 2. But between that time in January of 2001 to the current state and where we are at now in 2008, it's been a marathon battle, and I've given up pretty much my entire life chasing after this because I knew I was onto something, and I recognized its impact for society as a whole. And I thought initially I was just chasing German measles. But as it turned out, I was in the end analysis, I was chasing basically everything, because what we've discovered now in both diagnostic technologies as well as in human physiology, we've discovered that all vaccines and by extension all infectious diseases can and do cause the equivalent of microvascular strokes, because the immune system, the body's large white blood cells, attack foreign particles in our tiny capillaries and collapse them and cut off the blood supply to various organs. This causes disease symptoms immediately or over a time as chronic illness in both people and pets, for that matter. So we even have dermatologists and doctors of veterinary medicine at Penn State University and across the United States who find the same process happening at the injection site in various dogs and cats that they've injected. In fact, they've looked at the tissue and find that the immune response that causes this damage blocks off the small capillaries and leads to lack of oxygen to the tissue, which is why for everybody across the planet, that they have a common reaction to any vaccine injected into their skin. You have pain, you have swelling, you have redness, and the pain and swelling and redness are basically resulting from the body's immune response to the vaccine foreign things put in your body, which cuts off oxygen supply to the tissue. Now, that's okay, fine and dandy if we do it just to your arm at the injection site, but unfortunately, when this stuff gets into your blood supply, it goes through your whole body, and the same process over time can unfold in many different organs of the body. And unfortunately, when it happens to the brain, it's kind of like strangling yourself at small blood supply areas throughout your brain, and it leads to some very classic symptoms. Some people develop autism.
Could actually have like specific organ systems, which they're like weaker organ systems. So it might manifest as like cerebral strokes for one individual versus cause problems, say, in the kidneys for another.
Exactly so. And unfortunately, because the process is largely silent, the medical tools we use in blood work, we cannot see it. The neuroimaging tools we use to see if anything's happened to the brain is oblivious to this. And even coroner's offices, unfortunately, when they use their microscopes after a child dies and we say it's sudden infant death, like the diagnostic label of sudden infant death actually explains something, that's just a garbage can label for we don't know. But when we look at it, and if you take it to an electron microscope, which is 15,000 times magnification, and look at these small blood vessels, we find that in all these different areas of the brain, they've collapsed and shut off, which basically stops delivering oxygen to tissue. So by analogy, to make it easier for the listeners, if you have a large highway system coming through your city, and going down that highway system are a bunch of cars, the small cars, like red blood cells in your body, are carrying oxygen to go to the tissue. Now, when you go to the side streets and smaller side streets, in the human body, where oxygen is actually dropped off at the tissue level, is in the smallest of smallest blood vessels, and we call them capillaries. Now, the capillaries are so small that the small little red blood cells, like little cars on your highway, can only go through there in single file, one car at a time. And when they do that, they drop off oxygen to the tissue, pick up toxins and waste, and bring it back to you for you to breathe out in your lungs, or do you pass out of your body through various excretion activities. However, the problem here is that when the white blood cells, which are bigger than the red blood cells, are triggered by the vaccines or infectious diseases, they're like kind of like putting a bunch of big 18-wheeler transport trucks on your highway. And we make one trillion of these a day, and under acute infection or stimulation, up to 10 trillion. Now, you can see the problem here. If you acutely drop too many transports on your highway and they're hyperstimulated, they'll block off all the side roads and block off the single-lane driveways to your house. So the capillaries are closed off, they react, they close off even further, and you have no oxygen delivery to those areas of tissue, which affects your liver, your kidney, your brain, and many other organs in your body, leading to Crohn's, colitis, acute renal failure, autism, sudden infant death, learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, deaths after Gardasil vaccine for the teenage girls now. There's been 10,000 adverse reactions for it, and unfortunately, and most profoundly, Gulf War syndrome. Now, we have now been able to identify, using our new neurological diagnostic tools, we have a website out there now. It's being released to the public on October 6th called BrainGuardMD.com. And with something as simple as video recorded by your camera, we can go back in and extract the same common neurological damage in everybody, which we can now measure, which shows that this process has occurred and led to your disease or disorders. It's very profound. And more profoundly than that, we find that looking at individuals who died of polio or tetanus or measles, mumps, rubella in the pre-vaccine era, that we also can now see in their facial reconstructions the exact same neurological damage that we are now recording after vaccines for all these people. Now, this sounds like fun and fine and dandy, but to put this in perspective for the global result this has been, we now have one child in six with a specific learning disability. We have one in nine children with asthma. 15% of the children in our planet have attention deficit disorder, and this is only in the countries using these vaccines. We have one child in 87 with autism, and it used to be one child in 10,000 before these multi-vaccines came online.
Wow, wow.
This is, and it's progressively increasing, but unfortunately, when the vaccine manufacturers came out and were making this stuff, in 1983 and 84, the vaccine manufacturers in the world and the pharmaceutical companies were saying to the World Health Organization and to the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, they're saying, look, guys, we're not going to make these vaccines for you anymore because we're being successfully sued in civil litigation for causing death, for causing paralysis, for causing disabilities. And they're saying it's not profitable for us anymore, so we're not going to give you any more vaccines because unless we get some sort of law passed that say you cannot sue us. Now, the World Health Organization and the Food and Drug Administration and the Human and Health Services Commission in the United States were up in arms. They're saying, oh, my gosh, we're not going to have any vaccines, and there's going to be an outbreak of infectious diseases around the planet. Well, by strong-arming them that way, the United States government and in league with the Food and Drug Administration, and unfortunately, passed Public Health Law 66990, which is the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And that act specifically states that unless you, as a parent or a child or vaccine recipient, can demonstrate in the federal circuit courts of the United States that your damages occurred within 3 days of vaccine, you cannot sue the doctor, and you cannot sue the vaccine manufacturer, but you can go to this special court we set up, which is litigated by tax attorneys or tax judges, and they'll decide whether or not you're entitled to any compensation. But here's the analogy. If you bring your car into a mechanic and ask him to rotate your tires, and the mechanic doesn't put your lug nuts on tight enough, then if driving down the highway 4 days later your tires come flying off, you cannot sue the doctor, and you cannot sue the vaccine manufacturer. The final outcome of this, unfortunately, was once the vaccine manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies had legislation that protects them from ever being sued for a product they're creating that causes harm to the public. They basically were like a bunch of children with their hands in the cookie jar, and they've already eaten up all the 3 cookies, and they wanted to create more cookies, but now they created many more cookies. Now children don't receive 14 vaccines by the time they're 5. Today, they receive up to 15 different biologically active injections in their bodies by the time they're 5 years of age.
15?
They're up to about 44 to 50 now vaccines by the time they're 5 years of age, beginning within hours of birth.
Wow.
And the problem here...
All before they're 5 years of age.
Before they're 5 years of age. And the problem here, it's not the bugs that are causing the problem. It doesn't matter if they're attenuated or if they're weakened or if they're killed. When you put foreign substances in your body, and all these vaccine injections is the equivalent of putting 150 different antigenic determinants in these children's bodies. An antigenic determinant is the foreign protein sequence that goes along with measles or mumps or rubella or diphtheria or tetanus or polio or Gardasil that actually challenges your white blood cells to respond to these darn things, and unfortunately it's that response itself that's causing the problem. But again, even more profoundly, you can ask any doctor what causes autism, they say, I don't know. Sudden infant death, I don't know. Adverse reactions from Gardasil, they say, I don't know, and I don't think there are any. But then they say, how about what causes Alzheimer's? What causes Parkinson's disease? What causes Crohn's colitis? What causes inflammatory bowel disorder? They have no answers. How about chronic fatigue? They don't know. So then you ask them, well, how do you fix these problems? And they say, I give you this drug, this drug, this drug, this drug. And then you say, well, doctor, how does that drug work? And again, they don't know. So here's the problem.
And the drugs mainly are just masking the symptoms.
Unfortunately, the drugs are actually treating the adverse symptoms that were caused by the initial vaccination to begin with.
Yeah.
So if they don't know what causes a disease or disorder, and they don't really know truly how their drugs are giving or actually fixing it or palliating the symptoms, then this is, by analogy, it's kind of like trying to put a fire out without knowing how it's fueled. And sometimes you put water on an electrical fire and you'll cause more harm than good. So when we realize that this process is going on, that we can now record within hours and days after an individual's been vaccinated a very specific neurological damage that can only be caused by blocking the blood supply, then we see the same damage is there after Gardasil vaccination, is there after the anthrax series for the Gulf War vets, is there after measles, mumps, rubella for children to develop autism or learning disability or attention deficit disorder, and is there after sudden infant death. It's the same neurological damage, and it's the same neurological damage we now see that was there after these darn bugs were at us before we put them into needles for everybody. And ironically, even further, the young child who died shortly after birth from being exposed to German measles before he was born, the vaccine manufacturers took the bug from this child and actually used it to pass it through African green monkey kidney cells, aborted human fetal cells, to weaken it. And they assumed that weakening these bugs would remove its ability to cause a rash, a fever, and swollen lymph nodes, and that's the way we can put them in needles and give them to everybody. Well, here, again, that assumption was so wrong. Unfortunately, that young boy who died, in the brain biopsy, we look at him, all his microvessels to his brain were actually closed off. He died of strokes to his brain, very profound strokes. But then when we take this bug out and we put it into needles and now mandated across everybody in the planet to have, we have now found that the same process killing these children way back when is the same process that's causing all these chronic illnesses and diseases across our whole body for everybody. So the medical system, by not knowing what these things were doing to people, have the whole thing wrong. And when they thought they would get rid of what we call medicine, the virulence, the ability to cause a rash, a fever, a swollen lymph node, which is why your doctors tell you that these vaccines we've given are weakened or attenuated or killed. You have a killed polio a vaccine. By getting rid of the virulence, we thought then the best thing the body's doing is the white blood cell response and the antibody response. So we put foreign substances into these vaccines. In particular, we put in aluminum adjuvants. And aluminum acts as a stimulant that actually enhances the white blood cell response because we thought that was good. But unfortunately, what we've discovered is that enhanced white blood cell response in many individuals and in some individuals in particular is actually the core cause of disease and disorders for all these people. So by what we've done, we've actually enhanced the very process by which these bugs have been causing disease before we even put them in the vaccines. And
by
everybody,
using aluminum.
The aluminum, by analogy, is kind of like if you have a fish tank in an aquarium and you're going to go away for 2 weeks, you can go to the fish store and you can buy a little block that has the food pellets in it. And you put the block in your fish tank and it slowly releases the pellets over a period of 2 weeks to feed your fish. The aluminum in the vaccines is designed to achieve the same effect. They wanted to have some constant chronic stimulation of the immune system so the individual would maintain immunity if they ever see the bug again. So these aluminum adjuvants act like that fish block in the fish tank. So the process is not over when we inject the needle into the infant's or child's or teenage person or military vet's skin. The reaction you have at your skin where you have swelling, rash, and pain to a certain extent is the triggering of the white blood cell response, which comes into the area because it sees something foreign, and the pain comes because we're blocking oxygen to the area. The pain you experience at the injection site is no different from the pain a person having a heart attack feels because the heart attack pain is coming from a lack of oxygen to the heart. So that process, by doing that and by making the vaccines, use the aluminum to enhance this process. Once we inject it into your skin, it percolates through there, gets in your blood supply, and goes through your whole body. Now, that, by analogy, is like dumping 10,000 rubber duckies at the head of the Mississippi River, and where they end up downstream is a random event, but where they do get clogged in the small streams at the end of the river is the smallest ones where the duckies are too big to squeeze to fit down those pipes. And when they block off those small pipes to the brain, to the kidney, or to the liver, or to the bowel, then there's lack of oxygen at that tissue, and it's microstrangulation, and that's why we lose functions like learning and speaking and having coordination and have very sensory deficits. But the sad, sad, sad reality of this is that in adults, when we block off certain small blood vessels to parts of the middle part of the brain called the thalamus, when we do that, we create something called thalamic pain syndrome. And that basically means the areas in the human brain responsible for filtering and processing information, whether it's sensory for light touch or pleasure or pain or hearing things or seeing things for that matter, or filtering out information from the environment you don't want to attend to, these areas, when they get whacked at the small blood vessel level, by analogy, by microstrangulation, it turns previously pleasurable sensations like me stroking the side of your body or your skin or trying to hug you, it turns those sensations the brain thinks is pleasure to being very noxious and painful. So what we find in many of these autistic children, we have a sudden acute change in their ability to...
Oh, yeah, how they don't like to be held anymore, touched.
Yeah, but this is not social deviance, Dr.
Yeah.
Holmes. This is basically the infant who's preverbal and premotor, who basically is interacting with the world and finding that you touch my skin or you hug me, that's actually very painful for my brain.
Yeah, that's
interpretation.
Perfect. Yeah, to them.
So you find many of these children are bicycling their feet madly and inconsolable after some of these vaccines, and we don't know what's going on. But again, to keep putting the profound magnitude of this problem in perspective, using our new BrainGuard neuroimaging technologies, what again is based on facial reconstruction and some fancy contrast enhancements we've done, we've created quantifiable, measurable data and numbers that we can show before and after vaccines that these things have changed and we're actually causing acute neurological damage in the here and now, or retrospectively 20 years ago that we can now demonstrate has happened. But what we have also found...
Through the analysis of photographs. Would it be your videos?
The video is very helpful for us. It gives us more degrees of freedom, but the bottom line is we can measure it and put it to scientific statistics, and we find it statistically significant. So by analogy, if I take an x-ray of your arm and it's not broken, then I whack it with a baseball bat and take another x-ray and I find a broken bone, it's a very simple conclusion. Hitting your arm with a baseball bat, broken arm. Now, by the same analogy, if we use our neurodiagnostics we've created in BrainGuardMD.com, we take a picture of the human brain by looking at the facial, see that the brain is not broken. Then we give the vaccine. Then within 24 to 48 hours, we find that the brain is broken, and we say, well, that's cause-effect again. And what we do find, the same neurological damage is there no matter what the vaccine is, no matter what the history is, and no matter, and it was there before the vaccines came online. We have missed this core physiological process in the history of medicine of how these bugs have truly been killing humanity. Because we've
discovered the mechanism, like you've focused on the mechanism by which it's not only this ingredient or that ingredient, it's this whole range of artificial vaccinations.
Exactly.
And you've got the mechanism of it.
Exactly. So,
which is so important.
Well, very much so. So this is a form of vasculitis, inflammation of small blood vessels. But, you know, the same mechanism by which Vioxx, an anti-inflammatory marketed by Merck Frost, which killed 10,000 people, which was released out to the public in the year 2000, by 2002, the physicians all knew, and we're seeing that this is causing a heart attack and strokes. But unfortunately, when you have corporate dollars directing products to the community, they have more power than us to make things go their way. So it wasn't until 2004, until Vioxx was pulled from the market because the Food and Drug Administration said, oh yeah, the doctors were right, it's causing heart attacks and strokes. But the process by which Vioxx caused heart attacks and strokes, no one knew. We've discovered that mechanism in physiology. It's the white blood cell response to these foreign things in the body that's causing the microvasculars to be collapsed. Now, it's the same response to vaccine. It's the same response to many antibiotics as well, which is why some children lose their hearing after certain antibiotics. We understand the process that medicine has never been able to figure it out.
Wow.
Now, even experts in the area, you can even go Google this, and they say, we don't know how these vasculitis, we call them vasculitides, or inflammation of small blood vessels, has even caused in more people. There's a mechanism there we haven't figured out. By discovering that mechanism and developing ways that we can now measure the damage in the body non-invasively by photographic and video reconstructions of individuals before and after the vaccines, and looking at the microbiology, and now finding ways to reverse the process, where actually not only can we stop the darn thing in its tracks, we have a proof causation for the Federal Circuit Courts that this has actually been going on, which means we can sue these guys for everything they've got in Canada and other countries, except in the United States where they've protected themselves. And we can actually now go in there and fix the damage retrospectively, because unfortunately, what we've also learned with an international team of experts, and we're talking hundreds, well, I can't tell you the exact numbers, in Europe, in North America, and Mexico and otherwise, we've actually found out that very clearly that in the physiological derailment, that the same microvascular strokes that are happening in the brain have happened in the liver. And once we fix these things naturally, with natural health product solutions we can now offer, once we fix the liver, we fix the bone marrow, and the bone marrow can redirect itself and relay down the blood supply to the area, and the problems start to fix themselves. We can heal, we can cure, we can prevent, we can diagnose, and we can hold those people accountable in courts of law for what they've done to us all on this planet. It's horrendous.
It's overwhelming to think that now children of 5 years of age are having all these enforced inoculations. I mean, you've got a whole generation of children damaged by these things. That's overwhelming.
It is profound, which is why, unfortunately, when I discovered this, you know, I was elected by my peers to represent them at the highest echelons of organized medicine in Canada. They thought I was a bright camper, and I was doing many things for residents across Canada. I was negotiating affinity contracts to drop down the interest rates they have with the private banks and the student loans, creating programs by which bring funding back to them to help them get through the medical training. And that, so organized medicine saw that I was I had many things to offer the system. But unfortunately, when you get up to the higher echelons of organized medicine, in fact, I was even appointed resident editor of the journals, you get a unique opportunity to see how organized medicine in Canada truly functions at its bureaucracy level. And much like our federal government, unfortunately, those who have a vested interest in the outcomes and sayings of these supposedly independent bodies fund them. So our medical journals are funded by and large by the pharmaceutical companies, which pay for the advertising in journals. Our annual general meetings at medical conferences are paid for by these pharmaceutical companies, as well as much of the internal workings and, for that matter, funding of these organizations is dependent upon pharmacy, not just in the independent bodies, but also at the academic and university level as well. So when you become involved in disseminating information or scientific research that really can hurt pharmacy and bring truth to the public. Well, then the pharmaceutical companies, much like they did back for 1983 to tell them we're not going to give you vaccines because we're getting sued, they tell the medical bodies that, well, we're not going to advertise in your journal anymore. We're not going to provide support for your research and your institutions, which makes the physicians and independent scientists and the source of information for graduating doctors practicing in the community totally at the beck and call of the message that Big Pharma wants them to hear. So when we can't move and organized medicine can't move, then the message by which the public receives, and for that matter, the marketing by which these guys can go out there and direct the consumer market on TV, all ends with ask your doctor. Well, your doctor only knows, unfortunately, what the medical establishment can tell them, and the standard of practices we follow are also followed by the organized medicine that we have. Now, no one's really corrupt here, but there's always the constant gun behind our heads that if we do not do what they like, it's going to be costly for us. And when you have your journals potentially going bankrupt without having the pharmacy advertising, then we're in a very significant catch-22, which impedes progress, impedes doctors' abilities to heal and help, and allows big corporations like Merck Frost, Sanofi Pasteur, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline to fast-track and fast-run legislation that's going through Canada right now called Bill C-51 and Bill C-52, which irrevocably prevents natural health products, which are curative and actually preventable and very helpful, and which in many ways can replace many of these vaccines, from ever coming to market, because they're taking out their competition, and we're allowing it to happen. And our legislators and politicians are unfortunately in the same boat as we are as physicians relative to the people who have more money than us. And by example, in Washington on Capitol Hill, the congressmen are outnumbered 2-1 by the pharmaceutical lobbyists who spent over $800 million in the past 8 years to get their message across. We are outnumbered, we are outgunned, and we are outnumbered in terms of financial dollars. And when we as scientists go out there in the scientific community and publish our papers, which show conclusively, we show cause-effect of these vaccines, well, unfortunately, any corporation can hire its own experts if they have more money than you who will more than willing give you evidence to refute that. And beyond that as well, they also will go out there and put fancy-dancy commercials out on TV that just basically appeal to the emotions of an individual rather than actually do a proper marshalling of the evidence. Now, when you have any disease or disorder that can unfold in the population in one person in 15 or one person in 87, it's very easy with using scientific methods to actually bury that information in the sample you take to provide the information to say these things don't cause harm. Now, when you use the individual as his own case control, like we do, and you show they're normal before vaccination, and now we have concrete neurological damage after vaccination, the individual as his own case control basically allows us to see in real time that that individual was affected, and that individual isn't lost in the other 20 people who were not adversely affected. So that's the way to do it in scientific methods that actually show proof causation rather than throwing out the baby with the bathwater like we have been doing all these years.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Would this be related to, it seems to me, this is anecdotally, but it seems to me that there's a rise in the number of cerebral hemorrhages that when you start talking to people, I have a history in my family of cerebral hemorrhages, and you start talking to people, you realize this is very, very common. I wondered if this would be related to cerebral hemorrhages and to arterial venous malformations. Do you have any comment on that?
Most definitively so. And this is the sad reality of what we've done, is that simply put, what these foreign substances in our bodies, being they vaccines or enhanced vaccines with aluminum or infectious diseases, are doing, they are basically launching in medicine we call the extravascular coagulation cascade, which is the blood clotting cascade, which is supposed to happen outside the blood vessels, but it's happening inside the blood vessels by these hyperstimulated white blood cells. So what we're doing is we're causing blockages and small blood clots to multiple small areas of the blood supply, which, by example, if I cut your arm with a knife, it'll expose factors that allow the body to start providing clots to fix the tissue. So this process is okay outside the small blood vessels, but when this process gets launched inside the blood vessels, which medicine never knew it could do, and we've now discovered that this actually is happening using fancy microbiological tools and techniques, we launch the outside the blood vessel clotting cascade inside the blood vessels, and when it does that, much like when an adult has a stroke, an adult having a stroke now is a medical emergency. we've got 3 hours as physicians to get them to the hospital when they have symptoms to go throw in blood anti-blood clotting drugs that block the process. But if it's been more than 3 hours after the clot has been initiated, or for that matter, the neurological symptoms have been formed, we can't give these interventions in medicine because we have a risk of what we call hemorrhagic transformation. We can actually cause bleeding into the brain because the lack of oxygen to the tissue, the blood vessels have become very, very weak, and they actually can break and burst and lead to bleeding into the brain. We call that within-brain bleeding or intracerebral hemorrhage. The same process, unfortunately, can also occur after vaccination, which is why another sad reality of this whole nightmare we've done universally with these vaccines, we've had an increase in sudden infant death. But physicians in emergency medical departments or doctors in the hospitals, when a child dies or an infant dies and stops breathing, and we've now discovered the reason they stop breathing is we're blocking off the oxygen supply to the main breathing centers in the brainstem of the brain, so when they get blocked off of oxygen, the central drive for the breathing stops and the person stops breathing. We call it sudden infant death. But in the process there as well, because there's small blood vessels in the back of the eye that also get blocked off, it can lead to what we call retinal hemorrhages or bleeding behind in the retina. And doctors can see that in the emergency department with their ophthalmoscopes and see the bleeding there. But we can also sometimes see, and by coroner's office in these dead babies, we can also see bleeding into the brain. But medicine, because we don't know the process going on, we assume if we see bleeding in the back of the eye, retinal hemorrhage, or we see bleeding into the brain in a young infant who's died with no cause of death, we accuse the parents of shaken baby syndrome. We say that parent shook that baby and moved and jostled the brain back and forth, which tore these blood vessels, and so that child was abused. These parents are in jail across the world, across North America. One of my colleagues on our team, Dr. Mohammed Albayati, he's a double PhD toxicologist, microbiologist, spent all of his career working at University of California, Davis. He left that, like myself, leaving medicine several years ago, and he has sequentially overturned in court convictions of parents accused of shaken baby syndrome and other abuse, when we can now go back in the medical data and look and establish for the courts, this was not a death from some unknown process or parent shaking their baby. These are clear signs that the vaccines, or for that matter, the drugs that the children are receiving has actually caused these bleeding in, not only in the brain and into the back of the eye. So that's very profound. There was even a case of a set of triplets here in Ontario that Dr. Albayati took on, and the parents were accused of shaking all three babies at the same time because they had these sort of like signs of retinal hemorrhages, if you will, or bleeding from the small blood vessels. And then these parents were going to go to jail because the medical system provided the evidence on opinion that this suggests that the parents shook the babies. Now, come on. What parent in their right mind would out there could possibly shake all three triplets at the same time and then send them off to jail? That was overturned. The cases are all published in, go figure, peer-reviewed journals called Medical Veritas, which is peer-reviewed and not receiving any funding from pharmacy, because we can't get our stuff in the pharmaceutical-sponsored journals because they don't like this stuff. Because once the public becomes aware and realizes the magnitude of the damages we have caused, including Bill and Melinda Gates' Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations across the world, this has been a mistake and error since the very beginning of Edward Jenner, who brought out the smallpox vaccine, who was killing people way back then, in the 1800s, in the early 1900s. It's never gone away. But the process manifests itself in various different forms. But the process is also additive as well. So if an infant or a child has a concurrent infection, which challenges the white blood cell response, if they're immune tolerant, meaning they cannot tolerate these vaccines or their foreign antigens in them, then these things collectively and combined, and if you throw on antibiotics on top of that, these are all additive stimulations of the white blood cell response that can switch the person into a state of immune tolerance and launches this this clotting mechanism within the in the blood. And we even find now, in fact, there was even a paper article just recently written in the North Bay promoting the public health department's demand that all teenage girls received the Gardasil vaccine. They say in the article, well, there are anecdotal reports that some girls have fever or faint or pass out and blood clots, which would normally be there anyway. Now, they're basically saying that they're basically describing away the symptoms that come along with this process as things that would normally happen. They do the same thing. They say, well, the child was going to die anyway. The child was going to become autistic anyway. The Gulf War vet would have had this adverse reaction anyway. When you have 800,000 military employees deployed in Gulf War I and Gulf War II, and from Canada, from the United States, from United Kingdom and Australia, and only those soldiers, a quarter of a million of them now, are back in our countries with these chronic illnesses, these sensory processing illnesses, neuropsychological ailments, and we show the neurological damage that they have is exactly the same neurological damage we see after vaccination in the Gardasil vaccinated girls who have adverse reactions, or sudden infant death children after vaccines, or for that matter, autism after vaccines. It becomes a profound statement, because not one
whole. It's a huge range of problems that these vaccinations are causing. Like,
it's all human disease, unfortunately, everything from cancer to shutting down the blood supply, to blowing up the heart, to blowing out the brain, for blowing out the kidneys, but it's happening silently. So we think you get a vaccine, 3 days goes away, no adverse reaction, we're done and we're gone and we're safe. But unfortunately, we found that the process can wax and wane. It can be complete or incomplete. It can be come on years later. So that we're even finding that these women in the military who had this six series for vaccinations, who even when they get back home from the military, 18 months later, they're giving birth to infants with no arms and no legs. Exactly as we saw after thalidomide in the children during the women who were receiving thalidomide to get rid of morning sickness, and we find they're giving birth to children with no arms and no legs. The reason why there are no arms or no legs is not because the drug or the vaccine is actually damaging the development of tissue. It's damaging the supply of oxygen for the tissue to develop. So we basically have with vaccines the same process being launched and everyone receiving them that has caused the damages in children prenatally that created thalidomide. In the same way with the Gulf War vet women, 18 months after being back home, they're giving birth to children with the same process and the same defects. Now, this whole process is a generic process because across all vaccines, all infectious diseases, all foreign things in your body, and there are certain reasons in medicine and microbiology by which it can be more enhanced for one person than another. By analogy, you can handle peanut butter, and many other people can handle peanut butter, but some people can't handle it. They'll get a deathly reaction. Some people can handle penicillin. Others can't have it. It's a deathly reaction. And unfortunately, with these vaccines, some people can handle them, some people cannot. There's various reasons we can now tell in advance who can handle and who cannot. But beyond that as well is that even when you get the initial injection into your arm and you say 3 days goes by, okay, I'm better, everything's fine. But because we've complexed these vaccines with aluminum and the response triggering an immune response for several months to a year and 18 months after the vaccine went in your arm, is that process in of itself can eventually go intolerant. You can almost acquire an allergy, if you will, to the vaccine that you actually received. And because the foreign substances in the vaccine are complex with aluminum, they're slowly leached into your body, much like that block in your fish tank, over a period of months and years. So even a year down the road, you can develop some new disease or disorder. You have kidney failure, you have insulin-dependent diabetes, you have pancreatitis, you have Guillain-Barre syndrome, you have autism, sudden death, learning disabilities, you have all these problems that can emerge, and these problems are directly caused by these foreign things put in your body. It's not a single event. Unfortunately, what we have done, we've injected an entire beehive into your body with a bunch of baby bees that will mature at different times down the road. Now, you initially were not allergic to the bee stings, but unfortunately, 6 months to 7 months, 8 months down the road, because you're constantly being stung from the inside out, that once you do become allergic to it, we can't turn the allergy off. I can't come back and say to you, Dr. Holmes, look, you are now allergic to bee stings or penicillin or peanut butter, therefore you should no longer be exposed to peanut butter, bee stings, or penicillin. That's a great advice the physicians give you. But I can't tell you, oh, I'm sorry, I injected you with peanut butter, penicillin.
Yeah, bees and, poisons.
I can't turn it off, so it's there.
Yeah.
So even once you, and furthermore, the doctors don't realize that this is a cause-effect reaction.
Yeah.
Then we know in medicine, if we re-challenge the person with these things, that's clear evidence that the individual is now intolerant to it. And that's exactly what we find. And not just in the humans, also in the dogs. So we actually have the entire process by which the white blood cells block off these small blood vessels, happening in all the vaccines, whether it's for rabies, whether it's for distemper, whether it's for anything else in various dogs. And we find that at the injection site, now this is not my work, these are my colleagues who are doctors of veterinary medicine, work at Penn State University, Ivy League schools, and there's a whole cadre of them who all agree, and have to send letters and say, look guys, we have now conclusively shown that not only are these vaccines causing lack of oxygen delivery at the tissue site, which is causing all these adverse reactions in these pets, It's the same. This process is happening through the body, and I diametrically, absolutely refuse to give this dog any more vaccines. Now, the vaccine manufacturers go out there for the animals and ask them, here, please don't talk about this, and pay off people, okay, don't talk about it, so the public don't ever hear. But
yeah, they seem to have so much money, like for advertising, for lobbying. You said they outnumber the number of congressmen, and then they kind of control the whole medical establishment, like through even the education and how doctors are taught to treat diseases. It's like all they do is turn to a book to see what the newest drug is for that complex of symptoms. Like they don't seem to have any, so many doctors, like they don't deal at all with using natural substances or nutrition, or it's like always they just seem to turn to the pharmaceutical.
Yeah, well, here's the magnitude of the problem, Dr. Holmes. We now have we have 23,000 deaths per year reported in the Canadian Medical Association Journal per year, directly caused by Western medical practices and drugs. Now that's 23,000 deaths. We also have 14 million doctor visits per year across Canada. This is a country of 30 million people for relief from adverse effects from prescription drugs. Many of our senior population is on polypharmacy, which is also causing problems to the body and the liver. And then we also have 51% of the population at any given time on a prescription drug. And we have 1 million children receiving off-label uses of prescription drugs. And now Canadian Medical Association Journal, the Journal of American Medical Association, and the British Medical Journal all agree, and even high-powered ivory tower academic institutions are publishing articles. You can go Google them. We now accept that Western-based medicine, as it's currently practiced, is the number one cause of death and disease in our country. Death. We'll believe it at death. We know that. And we know that to be a fact. But no one else knows that. But, you know, this is ahead of HIV, AIDS, cancer, stroke, and heart attack. We know that. But we can't change the system because the system and what the doctors practice is mandated by the standards of care, which is dictated by the people who have a vested interest in selling you stuff, which controls us out of very legislation of our government. They control Health Canada. 4 years ago, our Food and Drug Administrator in Canada, Dr. Shiv Chopra, you can Google him as well, he published a book called Corrupt to the Core. And Dr. Chopra has said very clearly that he's been trying to use the science that he has, because he's there responsible for approving a drug for its approval in Canada, it's safe or unsafe. He said from the very beginning, 40 years ago, that these vaccines, there's no safety data for them whatsoever. The whole idea is a ruse. He said silicone breast implants not safe, and they overruled him because DuPont wanted to make his money. Well, we found out afterwards it caused cancer. He said bovine growth hormone not safe, they overruled him, but then when all the other countries are removing bovine growth hormone from the food supply because it's causing cancer, again, he was right. And he said many antibiotics, including Revelor and Baytril, unsafe, but they overrule him for the purpose of the corporate interests who have more money than us, who are controlling our bureaucracy in many ways, and are controlling our elected officials in many ways. And politicians, unfortunately, are not doctors. So they listen to the expert doctors who pharmacy hires to tell them we should be doing this. And yeah. Gardasil is the most recent, profound, crazy marketing scheme that is causing more harm than good. It is completely useless. And they know darn well that we can cure all strains of human papillomavirus within 3 days, pap smear to pap smear, with natural health products, herbal douche that I could drink a gallon of it, that all you have to do is use it as a douche for a half an hour for 3 days, pap smear to pap smear, gone. This means we can cure cervical cancer. But they are now knowing that these natural health products, which actually fix the problem in the human liver, which is the small blood supply has been blocked there, they know it exists. But they are fast-tracking legislation in our country right this very minute in Canada. Minister of Health Tony Clement from the Parry Sound District has put it before the House of Commons before this illegal election was called by Prime Minister Harper, saying we want Bill C-51 and its subsequent Bill C-52 be passed, which makes natural health products illegal. It's illegal to get vitamins, minerals, supplements, probiotics, and more particularly herbs, unless it's approved by the Minister of Health. Not Health Canada, not scientists or doctors, not before Congress in our parliamentary system, at the sole discretion of our Minister of Health. And once this legislation is passed, not only will the population not have access to that, ourselves as physicians and international experts who have means to go help people who have Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease or various cancers or adverse reactions to vaccines, or we can use natural health products to prevent illness rather than relying on prescription drugs. As soon as that's out, Big Pharma loses its stranglehold control of the population as a whole. They're now legally liable for all the damage they cause, which will bankrupt them in some countries, and they are bent on preventing this information of coming to public knowledge, because in for a penny, in for a pound. This is like having all the lions in Africa cornered in one corner. They have to come out tooth and nail fighting for everything they can possibly do, by any means they can do, because we're talking about the death of pharmacide in our country and the world, and it's going to be a battle. And they have more funds than us, and they're out to destroy the message, and if they can't destroy the message, they destroy the messengers. And if I was doing this within organized medicine, they would pull my license and say, you can't listen to Dr. Molden, doesn't have a medical license anymore. So in anticipation of that response, I've seen how they play ball. I actually had to leave 21 years of school and leave with my medical license intact and not let them have bearing control over me, that now they have nothing to come after me with. They can't take my license away. I left on good terms. I'm not practicing medicine as they want me. I won't do it, because prescribing drugs kills more people than not. And beyond that, I can now say the truth, and they cannot discredit me by taking out the messenger. But they'll find something else, and it's going to come. But I'm only interested in the health and wealth of my fellow citizens. I have nothing to gain or prosper by this. In fact, I've given up everything in order to come out and trying to get the truth forward for my fellow man. And I'm not alone. And we are been attacked by these people for the last 10 years. My colleague, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who started this whole concern back in 1997 in the United Kingdom, they decimated him. They drug him through courts for 10 years. They took away his license in the United Kingdom. He's gone with his tail between his legs, hiding in Austin, Texas right now, and he started up trying to help autistic children, because he recognizes, as I do, as my other colleagues around the world, that these vaccines can sometimes cause more harm than good. And what we have actually achieved is showing what that harm is, how it's happening, and we were so humbled to realize that this same mechanism is across the board, across many human diseases and many human disorders, and even further blown away by recognizing that now if we just fix the liver, the body's own immune system fixes itself. We're not curing disease. The body's own immune system is curing disease. We just have to give it that little kick to actually go do what it was designed to do by our Creator.
Wow. Wow. You used the word pharmacide. I think that's a neologism, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pharmacide, death through the pharmaceutical mafia.
Well,
you use that word, a pharmacide?
Yeah, I guess
that's a pretty good word.
That's a great word.
It's unfortunately, you know, well, I'll give you a very clear indication of where their heads are at and how they play these games. Even after Avioxx, the anti-inflammatory, was pulled from the market by the Food and Drug Administration for causing over 10,000 deaths from heart attack and stroke. In third quarter earnings after that happened, Merck Frost made $18.6 billion. From that, they put aside $750 million to defend themselves against future litigation for getting them charged for a wrongful death and people they've caused. They wanted to go fight it. And the funny thing is, even that we know that it caused heart attack and stroke and killed people, they know it, we know it, the doctors know it, the Food and Drug Administration knows it, that even when it gets in courts of laws, these guys were actually winning the cases on and legal technicalities, because they have more money to go throw at 20 Harvard-trained lawyers to go beat you out, even when you know they're guilty. So in the end, they ended up realizing they had a $50 billion blemish on their bottom line. So they actually were able to litigate themselves out and offer the world, here, we'll give you $5 billion, everybody go away, you can go take your small piece of that pie, and then leave us alone. So they got away with murder, and there was no accountability. When you profit off of something you've caused harm or death, then there's no disincentive for them to stop doing things differently. When they pass laws that prevent them from being charged and actually held accountable for what they've done, they have no disincentive. So to them, it's just it's a numbers game. We'll make more money than we'll ever get sued for killing and harming people, so we'll just keep putting our products out there and use our Donald Trump-trained apprentice wannabe Harvard MBAs to go out there and market stuff that they have no idea what they're marketing. And marketing achieves more impact in contemporary society than any truth in science, especially when they can control and block that. So truly, by looking at it, when they put questions out on TV and advertisements, say, ask your doctor, well, your doctor's information not only comes from the medical journals, which are controlled by pharmacy, it also comes from these Pamela Anderson-looking, very articulate pharmacy reps who go door-to-door with their free samples and colorful graphs, and make the doctors feel pretty good actually having their attention, and tell them, here's a new drug, it does this and this and this. So that when a patient comes into the doctor's office, after seeing commercials on TV, say, ask your doctor, the patient says, doctor, I heard about this new drug and that, for this problem. And the doctor goes, hey, well, you know, I've got free samples. Here you go. And then the whole mechanism repeats itself. It is unfortunately corrupt. Some things do good, some things do harm, but when you have an industry bent on making a profit over the betterment of the fellow man, and they can profit irrespective of causing harm, it's a numbers game for them, and this is the system of our Canadian healthcare system, which is why it is so messed up right now, and we are fully intent on getting the Ottawa to fix it, because when they can fire our Food and Drug Administration and say things are safe or not safe, when they cannot listen to the Parliament of Canada, when they do not listen to the people of Canada, when they control our organized medicine and indirectly control our frontline physicians who are trying to help individual patients, we are all stuck, everyone. But the only way to get out of this unstuck situation is to go hold these people accountable. So our lawyers in Washington said to me, Andrew, you know, they won't listen to parents, they won't listen to doctors, they won't listen to scientists, they won't listen to parliamentary people, they won't listen to anything other than the mighty dollar, which is why when they see me coming to sue them, they listen to the lawyers because they know the lawyers are after one thing, we want their money. So that is the only person to listen to. Unfortunately, the force is the only way we can stop this and change the system to better our fellow man is to go sue them. And in Canada, thankfully, we have the Hazardous Products Act, which says it does not matter whether the individual or corporation knew or did not know that their product caused harm or death. The fact that it did means that we can sue them for every penny they have for the damages they've caused because these laws are in place to protect the average citizen in Canada. So they have no escape here. And unfortunately, there's never been a case brought before the Supreme Court of Canada, or for that matter, against pharmacy in Canada, because our wards here in Canada are not as big as they are in the United States. So the pharmacy keeps that at bay by realizing they can throw 10, 20, 30 million at it and basically drown out the individual coming after them. We fully intend in time to take class action suits at them, because when now we can show causation, we will get it, and we will get them, and we'll stop this.
Assuming that you can get into an impartial court not controlled by the same elites who control the government and the medical establishment and the universities and the police.
Well, here's the best measure to tell you that we have truth and we're doing a great job. One, I'm presenting all my evidence to the global vaccine community and scientists, including Merck Frost and all these guys, at the first World Annual Congress in Vaccinology in Guangzhou, China.
When's that coming up,
that's
Andrew?
December 1 to 5. So I'm basically walking into the Coliseum, the Lion's Den. So
wow.
If I come out alive, great. But basically I'm showing them, here's our evidence, boys. It is proof causation. Like an X-ray, the brain is not broken before you vaccinated these people. And here you can see for yourself, no fancy statistics. You broke it, and you've done it for everybody. So that will be pretty enlightening. That's actually, if you Google World Congress of Vaccinology or Vaccines in China, you'll see that I'm logged up there. They put me on their scientific advisory board. I'm a chairman of two sessions, and they'll get the truth there. But
wow.
Here to tell you that we really are on the right track is that all my evidence was dumped into the Federal Circuit Courts about 4 weeks ago in the United States, which is the Vaccine Injury Courts. And, you know, if you have something that they're not worried about that can come into court and they can argue it and beat, you know, they let that evidence come into court and they go decimate it. But when they see the evidence coming and they recognize that, how are we going to beat this? Well, the legal teams from these big vaccine manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies do everything they can to prevent that evidence ever from being presented in court. And I just got a call from the lawyers the latter part of last week that's exactly what they've done with the evidence we brought forward. They're trying to disallow it from coming into court. So, you know, it's kind of like O.J. Simpson. If the judicial system, if the lawyers can argue they can't bring in that glove, then we can never prove causation. They say we have proof causation, so now their attempt to stop it is to stop it whatever way they can by their legal wranglings before it gets to court and it gets a judge and people to actually see the truth.
Well, it's an absolute nightmarish situation. Like, I can understand why people say this is part of the eugenics plans of these kind of elites. To me, it's hard to imagine how can these people in these corporations knowingly be spreading such poisons through the community, their own communities.
But I don't think they know. I think that what Andrew's suggesting is that I don't think that that's a conscious attempt to harm people. I think it's misguided and mistaken. Isn't that what you're suggesting?
But I mean, they cover up all the evidences. They persecute people who question their results.
That's economics. But I mean, originally the idea behind vaccination was thought to be good for public health. I mean, and it certainly seemed that the evidence suggested that it was good for public health. And it's, well, we're talking about something that hasn't been recognized. Like, what strikes me is that there's a common mechanism in the vaccination process. I think that's quite astounding.
Yeah, very important.
The implications are so incredible. I wanted to pick up something that Andrew mentioned earlier, though, about antibiotics, which is, I think, sort of, it's the other side of the whole marketing thing, is that people's expectations are created in terms of healthcare are created by this marketing process. So, for example, all children pretty much have inner ear infections, and the way that they're generally treated is by prescribing antibiotics. However, the research is very clear that treating inner ear infections with antibiotics is no more effective than just allowing them to resolve themselves. But you have a kid with an inner ear infection, you take them to the doctor because they're in discomfort, and people want doctors to prescribe antibiotics. I think that's, you know, the research is quite clear about that. And unfortunately, the reason why they want them is because they've been told, well, that's how, this will be fixed. And also, the expectation is, well, I have to do something rather than, in that case, just allowing things to resolve naturally. But unfortunately, that can lead to giving antibiotics in those situations can lead to very harmful effects and extremely harmful effects. Is Andrew still with us?
Yeah, I certainly am. I'm listening.
would you agree with that, Andrew, that there's sort of this expectation is created through the marketing process is that people, that patients do demand antibiotics and medications that are really not good for them, partly, a large part because that it's seen to be doing something for a condition? Do you think that's part of it?
Yes, here's the medical mystery of the century is that Western medicine has cured nothing. It uses cut, burn, and poison to fix everything that it does. So if you have not cured anything that you are doing is only palliating symptoms. Palliating symptoms, or for that matter, putting diagnostic labels to something, which is a collection of symptoms, does not explain how the disease emerged. So unless you can find in the mechanism by which disease is caused, you cannot cure disease. You cannot stop it, but you can throw things at it to dampen it down. You're kind of like, antibiotics is kind of like throwing flame retardant on a fire. But go down to where the spark is and turn off the mechanism, then you turn off the disease and you turn off the fire. That's what you do. But marketing is a critical, critical means. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry has learned that they can spend hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing and then go out there and give big cases of scotch to doctors on golf courses. They can give Big Bertha golf clubs. They can take them to fancy places and wine and dine them and do all kinds of great things for them. And they find that marketing dollar is never lost because they recoup it back by the prescription practices of the physicians. So we live in a society today wherein the advertising is more powerful than the scientific data that we bring forward. So by analogy, many people have bought into it. I know you think it's kind of foolish, but many people truly believe that if you throw Axe body spray on your body, a bunch of beautiful women are going to chase you down the street, and that's going to happen. That's marketing. And when we first published, when Dr. Wakefield first published his results in the medical journal Lancet that suggested a link between vaccinations and autism in 1997, the response from the pharmaceutical company was instantaneous, and they, including the General Medical Council over there, which in this past year, Dr. Wakefield has successfully shown in behind doors courts that these guys all lied, including the editor of the Lancet Journal on behalf of pharmacy. But when you go out there, and we say these things in the scientific literature, we try to stand up, we lose our jobs, we lose our credibility, and most physicians have a large debt after medical school, they have their lives to live, and they're afraid to stand up here because they realize and they make examples of us that the hammer will come down on us so hard they'll destroy our lives. So with that caveat in mind, after we put scientific evidence out there to show it going one way, the pharmaceutical company has their own guys in tow who are scientists and reputable, including the infamous Dr. Paul Offit in the United States, who does nothing but out there and publish books and basically become a spokesperson standing in front of his medical credentials as some person that's actually independent out there giving information to tell him it's all safe. Well, Paul Offit is actually the Morris Hilleman Chair for Vaccines and Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Morris Hilleman is the guy from Merck Frost who made all these vaccines, so there's no independence whatsoever. The public don't see these things. And then so on top of that, the marketing response to that, so when Dr. Wakefield was bringing his concerns to the United States, to the United Kingdom government, the pharmaceutical industry puts across millions of dollars in advertising going on TV in a 30-second clip. And the 30-second clip was this. They had a young infant sitting at the edge of a shorn cliff. When you look down, waves crashing into jagged rocks. And the child sitting there alone, the infant sitting there alone, in front of him is prowling back and forth is a menacing lion with its teeth shown and drooling from the mouth. And the caption at the bottom of the screen is this: would you put your child in this danger? Then why would you not vaccinate? That degree of marketing overwhelms. We could put 100 papers out there per month, and these scientific papers cost a fortune. They've blocked our funding. The 2004 Vaccine Safety Review Board by the Institute of Medicine in the United States, which is basically held accountable more times than not indirectly to people's liaisons back to the pharmaceutical industry. Not only did they come out and say that the evidence says vaccines are safe, they said that there is no evidence that they are unsafe whatsoever, so they actually said across the board, you have to stop supporting financially physicians and scientists and academia who want to go out there and do studies and research to look into the effects of vaccines on our health. So all of my colleagues all of a sudden have their funding pulled from the institutions. They end up being world-renowned scholars. They're out of jobs. So they cut the message off, and you'll never find the truth. So the, no one funds us. No one supports us. I don't have a job anymore, but unfortunately, I can't stay with my job of promoting practices that cause more harm than good for just because I'm afraid of what the consequences to me and my career would be. That is not what we all enter medicine for. That's not upholding the Hippocratic oath to do more good than harm, and that's not integrity. So I will spend the remainder of my life tackling this problem, but when you get up to the highest echelons of organized medicine, and you see the problems that are how big corporations are controlling truth at that level, then when you also look at the political scene as well, our politicians are in the same boat. We even have a five-time elected Liberal MP from Bramley Gore Malton, Mr. Gurbak Singh Mali, who I was sat down with this summer and showed him our natural health product solutions for some diseases and disorders, including something he had. He asked us to help him. He knows we could. We offered to bring him out of the country because we can't offer the solutions here and to get him treated, but he couldn't go because it goes against the party line, and then they knew we would use it in a political campaign saying, well, here you go. These people can't, if they can't help themselves, how can they help you? So even the politicians, and Gurbak Singh Mali is part of the Privy Council in Canada, which advises our government what to do back to the Queen. So if they can't help you, if they're hamstrung, imagine how the doctors feel are trying on the front lines trying to help you, and more times than not, they don't really know what the truth is because they are equally subjugated to the same marketing scheme, Axe body spray type commercialization that leaves the doctors confused after medical school more times than not. You could ask any doctor, what were the initial trials on that particular drug you're peddling? What were the contraindications? What were the adverse effects? Who actually did the study? Where are the safety studies for it? And they can't answer the question. So we're being used as pawns upon which to sell a product for profit to the public, and many of these drugs and vaccines have a $3,000 to sometimes $100,000, 100,000 point markup on what they actually cost, and they get away with it. When we want to offer solutions for free, they don't want that to happen because, you know, much like Nikola Tesla, who was creating the Waldner Tower, where people get free energy directly from the ionosphere, was being funded by J.P. Morgan. And when Morgan asked him, well, Nikola, where are we going to put the meter? And he said, well, there's no meter to put it. So he stopped the funding because you can't sell it to somebody for profit. These people who fund them don't want you to have it.
Yeah. Are you familiar, Andrew, with Dr. John Sarno and healing back pain? Do you know his work at all?
No, unfortunately, I do not.
I just struck by what you're talking about blood deprivation. I don't know Sarno's work very well, but I know the basic, what his basic position is that back pain is generally attributed to structural functional problems in the back, but he claims that most back pain is really due to a condition of mild oxygen deprivation, which is caused by emotional factors. And what he's essentially is saying is that people experience back pain by and large not because of any kind of damage to the actual back, but because of they're having emotional or stress reactions, and as a result of that, they're cutting off oxygen supply to the tissues, and that's what results in the pain. That is sort of struck that that's kind of, well, what you're describing is much more serious than actual pain, but it's you know, again, it's a deprivation of oxygen. It pain is the first sign that you're being deprived of oxygen, right?
And then very much so. And this is sad reality of all this is that this is the common mechanism across all human disease and all human disorders. So Alzheimer's disease The damage to the brain attracts along the microvascular supply, creates a big C from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. Lack of oxygen. The pancreas, the blood vessels in the areas of the cells in the pancreas that create insulin to drive sugar into your cells, those cells in a small area of the pancreas are in an area of small blood vessels that in themselves, over time, they slowly get strangulated out, you lose them, you have insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. It's the same process in human physiology across all human disease, across all human disorders. It's basically the body's immune response to foreign things in the body that's causing disease and disorder, not our response to a foreign germ in and of itself. Now, this whole ruse was played a part across Western medicine at the time of Louis Pasteur. In Louis Pasteur's time, his contemporary, Antoine Béchamp, was basically saying something completely different from Louis Pasteur. And Pasteur's claim to fame was the germ theory, that we have disease and disorders in our bodies created by germs. That worked very well for the pharmaceutical company because they could sell antibiotics, they could sell vaccines to go fight the germs because that works. But Pasteur knew that Antoine Béchamp, a French physician who was saying and scientist saying, well, it's not the germs that are causing disease, guys. It's actually your body's immune response to these germs or to foreign things in your body that's causing disease. Even Louis Pasteur on his deathbed said, well, you know what? Hey, guys, you know, I wasn't right. Antoine Béchamp was right, but, you know, no one's heard about Antoine Béchamp. No one's actually hears about a medical school because Antoine Béchamp's basically whole theory, which turns out to be absolutely correct, is not good for pharmacy because you can't sell stuff for it because this is the whole ruse. And if you look at it carefully and think about it, it makes perfect sense. By example, when you inhale asbestos fibers, large fibers from asbestos, it lodges in the very bottom of your lungs, and it causes lung cancer. We call it mesothelioma type of cancer in the lung. Well, asbestos fibers are not bugs. They're not germs. They're an inorganic particle. The asbestos fibers themselves do not cause cancer, but because they're in the body and they constantly stimulate the white blood cells to come in the area because the white blood cells are trying to get rid of it, because the fibers are long and narrow, the white blood cells cannot engulf them and digest them and get rid of them, the white blood cells open up their toxic enzymes and cause damage to the tissue, and it's the transformation of the tissue in the area from the white blood cells, which are being triggered by the asbestos, which causes the tissue to transform itself into cancer. The same thing happens in the cervix for cervical cancer. It happens in the breast for breast cancer. It happens in the prostate for prostate cancer. It happens in the brain for Alzheimer's disease. It happens in the small parts of the brain called the basal ganglia for Parkinson's disease. It happens in the pancreas for pancreatitis and insulin-dependent diabetes. It happens in the kidneys for acute renal failure. It happens throughout the whole body. In fact, it even happens in part, it's part of the process by which our small blood vessels, our blood vessels in general, are hardened by atherosclerosis or hardening the arteries. So what we are finding is that many of these things we're able to fix. Well, we don't fix it. We fix the process that's been derailed in the liver, which is the detoxifying agent in the whole body. Once we fix that, the body fixes itself. But, you know, this is natural. It cannot be patented by the pharmaceutical industry. So by analogy, where we are right now in contemporary medicine is a turning point, a paradigm shift, the opportunity to help communities who need health care, who need physician care, who need treatments that cure and fix and not treatments that palliate and cause more sickness. But unfortunately, by analogy, the pharmaceutical industry is like a bunch of candle makers. They were making make candlesticks for all these years, and now we've come out with the electric light bulb, but they don't want the electric light bulb to come out because it puts them out of business, and they can't buy up the electric light bulb because it's all natural. They can't go buy something that's natural, and so their job primarily is to stop you from hearing about the candle and pass laws in our country that makes it impossible for us to ever tell you or provide you the candle because they want the light bulb because they want you to still buy candles. And this is the position we're at. It's imminent in our country right now. Within 2 months of the current government coming into power, they will pass Bill C-52, and by that point forward, that Dr. Molden and all the international physicians who want to tell you about natural health products, the naturopaths, the herbologists, the traditional Chinese medicine practitioners, the eclectics, all these people who have natural ways to help human disease, pain, and disorder will be forever shut down. And if we talk about it, and if we try to tell you there are natural solutions to health care and disease, the government right now has already been going out to the universities, hiring up individuals to go police the state and actually take us out and throw us in jail and give us a $5 million fine and confiscate anything we have to give the public. We give it to them for free and basically make it you only have one option to buy the pharmaceutical drugs. When you have 51% of the population on a prescription drug and they want more patients and no one's being cured, we have a serious imminent problem. We have more chronic disease and disorders in our country and in North America than we've ever seen in the history of medicine. There have been no advancements other than selling more drugs. There are no more drugs to come down the pipeline. We haven't had a new antibiotic for 20 years. They are stuck. And now not only can we help and take them out of business, we can also provide solutions and also hold them accountable. They can't let it happen. So they come out fighting. And the only way to change the system is to become the system and to get in there in government and get the legislation passed that protects our health freedom. And we have a constitutional lawyer, Sean Buckley, who is the president of the Natural Health Products Protection Association. He's already written the Charter of Health Freedom, which will forever protect the population's opportunity to receive information and the doctor's ability to tell you about it, things that are not pharmacy-related, because it's a monopoly, and they're taking us all out, and it has to stop. It does not stop now. It's forever lost, and we will be completely stopped from able to cure and treat disease and do it properly at its core cause, not at symptomatic relief that makes money for these guys. I don't want to profit off anyone. I just want the people who I love and care about, my country, to be safe, to be healthy, to have freedom of choice, and live a life under our democratic constitution and charter rights for freedom.
Hey, Chris, perhaps we could give out the numbers there. Would you be interested in giving out the numbers for telephone calls?
Because we have less than half an hour left, and I did want to go on with Andrew to talk a little bit about CAP and his running for office.
Okay, I think we have to have Andrew back on to take some telephone calls, because I'll bet there are people who would like to speak to him. I mean, there's just been a whole volume of information that he's presented, which is... I'm sure there would be all sorts of people that listening would have questions or have comments perhaps related to their own situations or just, general questions about what Andrew said. I mean, it's quite a shocking...
Yeah, it's a huge amount of information.
Quite a brilliant presentation, too, I might add. Andrew is just fantastic.
Thank you, Jim. But, people, I like this as well. Colleagues around the world say, Andrew, you're brilliant, you're a genius, and I'm a pretty humble man, so my answer is this. I say, well, I'm not really brilliant or genius. By analogy, this is what's been going on. All these years, the doctors have been coming into their offices every day, sitting down and eating their lunch off of this big rubber table that they sit on. They've been doing that for the last 50 years, and they do that every day. All I've done is come along into their offices, and I've taken that rubber table, turn it on its side, threw an axle through it, and rolled it down the hill, and I say, oh my gosh, Dr. Molden, you're brilliant. You've discovered transportation. I said, no, I'm not brilliant. You guys are foolish. You've been eating off a tire all these years. So all the information is out there. I've been on several radio shows. People just have to Google my name, Dr. Andrew Molden, and you'll find the Genesis Network on Republican Broadcasting and many different radio shows that I've actually been talking about this stuff with other physicians and colleagues. It's out there.
Good.
And now, again, keep in mind that there are people out there who don't want you to hear the truth or see the truth. So you'll find some sites where they have these but they're making Dr. Molden look like he's crazy, he's a lunatic, or well, that's fine.
That's part of their disinfo. Program.
So that's there. And by and large, if you just want to read it in a very simple, short, 5-minute protocol, all the information, including the slides of the blocked vessels, are on our BrainGuardMD.com site, which shows quite clearly what's been going on. I don't want to be the bearer of this bad news, but the good thing is that there's hope, because we do have means now to go in there and correct some of this damage, because once we can establish the process has occurred, we now have even a strong measure by which we can show how we're fixing the damage afterwards, because the brain, as it turns out, is not irreversibly damaged. And when we fix the problem in the liver and the bone marrow and the immune system, the body starts fixing itself. It's not the... In some areas of the brain, the gray matter, the thinking cells of the brain, which is kind of like the outer cortex or the bark of a tree, if that's ever damaged, we can never bring that back to bear. We cannot fix that. And that's permanent damage. But when the blood supplies crossing all the areas of the white matter tracks, which are kind of like the cables leaving one lamp to go plug in the wall, when we fix those areas, those connections can regrow. So by essence, we allow the brain to replug itself in, and by analogy, much like the patients in the movie Awakenings with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, where you had people who were exposed to Spanish flu during the 1980s Spanish flu, they would not speak, and they were locked in the hospitals for 40 years. that then all of a sudden, with the proper medication, they all of a sudden woke up and started speaking again, not with the vocabulary of an 8-year-old child when they were first harmed, with the vocabulary of an adult, because their brain was processing information. The reason why these children cannot speak, the reason why people have all these healthcare problems, is many of these neurological pathways have been cut off. They're disconnected. And we call it disconnection syndromes in neurology and psychology. And all we allow to do by helping it naturally allows the brain to fix the problem with the blood supply and the immune system and the liver, and these areas all of a sudden plug themselves back in together, and all of a sudden you have return of function, which is humbling.
That's really nice to have that to end on that positive note, that you also have natural cures that can help to reverse a lot of these problems. I mean, that's amazing.
We can't cure everything, but unfortunately, good thing is we can help the body fix itself. And unfortunately, every drug, and I mean every synthetic drug, you can look in the compendium of pharmaceuticals or anything on the internet or anywhere you want and ask any doctor, every drug is toxic to the liver. Here's the problem. The liver is our solution for fixing everything. So if you're taking drugs to fix symptoms of a disease, whether it's pain in your back or other disease or disorders, if it's toxic to the liver, not only are you taking away the symptoms by palliation, you're also impairing your body's natural ability to go heal itself. We're taking out the spark, and the fire is going away, rather than going treating flames and smoke and heat. And that's the solution.
I remember reading this guy, this cancer, alternative cancer guy, saying that he'd never seen a case of cancer that didn't originate with a compromised liver, that cancer always involves compromised liver function.
that's why, and here's the sad reality of this whole, this is the situation that doctors and medicine's now in. So even when we go out there and we have a proctologist who actually has prostate cancer himself, and he spent his whole life doing prostatectomies and surgical procedures, because he's a surgeon, to fix prostate cancer and otherwise. When he gets prostate cancer, and he came to us because, you know, we fixed his wife's breast cancer, and he finally gave in, I don't want to have this surgery. He comes to us. We cure his prostate cancer, and he had to testimonial for us, and we have to record it all because our stuff's going to come out in literature by the new year in the medical journals. But here's the story. Once he sees that and we can do that, he's blown away, and he can't believe it, but he goes back to his medical practice and does prostatectomies. That's all he knows how to do.
Yeah.
So what do they do? They've been trained this. So the physician's going to need a whole new wake-up call and a whole new change, and the slower it takes us to get to that point, the longer it will be before we finally can actually start curing disease rather than causing disease.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at now in history. It's a revolution for the 21st century, and it's coming, and unfortunately it's not going to be an easy battle upwards, because those who have a vested interest in stopping this from coming forward will do their darndest to make sure it doesn't come forward.
Yeah, it's amazing. It the whole problem with inoculations and the medical establishment, it reflects the same problems we find in the political realm, in the financial realm. Like, it's like there's a global awakening of people, like, realizing our governments are criminal, that, you know, they're not representing us, they're serving the corporate elite, and they're, I mean, these bills that are bills C-51 and 52, I mean, that's incredible that the government would actually want to prevent us from being healthy and having health products. I mean, it's such a serious problem, and it ties into the broader problems in our whole society in realizing the corruption of the system.
Well, I would like to
move along a little bit here, just to bring up, Andrew, you're running for the leadership of the Canadian Action Party.
That is correct. When you see political problems causing health problems and sovereignty problems for your nation, the same corruption, unfortunately, that's blocking health care is also blocking our government from being able to stand up on behalf of the health, wealth, and sovereignty of our nation. It's the same corporate interests that are doing the same job there. So when you want truth and you want to speak truth to power, unfortunately, you can stand on the doorsteps of Parliament Hill and heckle all you want and try and get someone's attention. The only way to truly fix a sick system is to become the system yourself and speak directly face-to-face, because that way the public hears the message. Because right now, 63% of our media is controlled by three companies. There's only 6 independent newspapers in our country, and everyone hears the same tainted voice. The public needs to hear the truth. The politicians want us to tell the truth. Unfortunately, they can't allow that to come out either. They have to toe party lines. So running for leadership of the Canadian Action Party, it's the only party across Canada that's talking about the issues of truth on multiple fronts.
of North American Free Trade Agreement, of the idea that they want to go right now in North American Union, and where our country is being sold out to corporate interests who actually now have more rights in our country than we do as individual citizens. Our country is being successfully sued under North American Free Trade Agreement rules by independent bodies using Chapter 11 statutes in the United States, where we're being sued successfully by corporations who have more rights in our knowledge to overturn Supreme Court of Canada decisions, because we're restricting their access to trade in our country, where we have to give them all our water, where we have to let them come in here and buy up our healthcare system, or buy up our resources, or buy up our industry, and buy up our big corporations that actually put jobs and food on the table in Canada and move them somewhere else.
Our whole country is being taken apart, brick by brick, sector by sector, and it's hidden from the population because all their corporate media, like no one in the elections talking about the SPP and deep integration or any of these things.
I agree.
Like everything in the media is just a complete fraud.
Exactly. So the North American Free Trade Agreement was the precursor. So even at the in February 23rd last year, they had a Security and Prosperity Partnership meeting outside of Ottawa where have all these international corporations attending. Now, this includes the Council of Foreign Relations in the United States. This includes, in Canada, Mr. Thomas D'Aquino, who's the president of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, Corporate Canada. They're sitting down there, and when one of the individuals comes out from that meeting, and this was Aron Covey, who's a director with Lockheed Martin, the world's largest munitions dealer, his message to the media was exactly here, word for word. He said that the message from the ministers, our government, to them was, tell us what needs to be done and we'll just do it. Meaning that rather than go through the parliamentary process, where the public has a chance to debate things like the Security and Prosperity Partnership or how they're changing our laws and regulations in food, drug, and sovereignty, they actually are going to do it by outside orders of council, which means individuals and regulatory bodies outside our country are making the laws for our land, not our democratically elected officials. This is a direct threat on the very existence and foundation upon which our country is strong, free, united, and sovereign. But as soon as we lose this, we are done. Canada will exist as a flag, and nothing else will matter. When you right now have North American Free Trade Agreement is a bad deal for Canada, working families, our environment, our sovereignty, and we need a trade policy that protects our democracy, social services, natural resources, and way of life. But we're not getting it.
No.
And they're not talking about it.
No.
So even when Prime Minister Harper this past year removed the access to the database for freedom of information, which is designed to keep our governments transparent, accountable, and the journalists in Canada vote Prime Minister Harper for receiving the Code of Silence Award. He is shutting down members of Parliament. He was gagging the scientists, and he is gagging our parliamentary process because he doesn't want the public to know what they're doing, because they have to implement these changes incrementally so that we'll wake up one day and say, well, where'd this come from? Because you can accept small changes at a time, especially when you're not aware of them. But Canada is screaming, and the Canadian National Parties are screaming, but the Liberals, the Conservatives, the NDP, and the Green Party, no one is speaking of what's going on. Within 3 days of this election being over, they already have meetings that set down with the European Union people for deep economic integration with Canada. We lose our borders, we lose our sovereignty, we lose the ability to make decisions for ourselves, by ourselves, and we now have the craziness of all this. Is our country is being successfully sued. We have already been sued for corporations who say you're restricting our free trade. The government has to spend out $300 million in the Ethyl case because the government said ethyl is bad, and MMT is what it's called, is bad as an additive to gasoline because it's causing things like attention deficit disorders and neurological problems. But these corporations outside our country, not only did they beat us down in our courts and cost us $200 million in legal fees and went to pay a fine of $133 million, they actually were able to force members of Parliament to stand up in front of the community and tell them, oh yes, this stuff is safe and we apologize. This is the profundity of what's going on.
Well, our government has completely sold out to the corporate and financial elites. I mean, it's terrible. It's a complete undermining of our democracy and the principles of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it's terrible.
It is horrible. So even Deputy Prime Minister Paul Hellyer, who was the Deputy Prime Minister under Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and Paul Hellyer has been in our government since the time of Lester B. Pearson. Deputy Prime Minister Paul Hellyer actually founded the Canadian Action Party in 1997, and he saw that we were making a mess. In fact, he even predicted where we'd be today financially, where we've gone from $18 billion in federal debt in 1974 to now we are at $588 billion in debt and still going up, and he recognized the moment we moved ourselves away from funding our infrastructure for our country, both federally, provincially, and municipally, from the Bank of Canada, which is our bank, which we own, which gives us money for these things interest-free. And when we did give up that right and went out to start using private banking, we're now borrowing from private banks, paying 5 to 6 to 7% interest on loans to fund our highways, our roads, our municipal programs, our provincial infrastructure, and it's costing us a fortune. Why would we borrow from somebody else and pay them interest when we can borrow from our own Bank of Canada for free? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's
killing our nation.
It's the same scam as you have in the States with the Federal Reserve. And there's lesser need for it in Canada because we still have the Bank of Canada.
It very much so. We have the only publicly owned bank in all of North America, and our governments are not using it. This bank got us through the Second World War. This bank paid for our Trans-Canada Highway. It paid for our St. Lawrence Seaway. It paid for much infrastructure. It got us out of the Depression, and we did it very fine. But now, all of a sudden, because of a chap by the name of Milton Friedman, the Chicago group, they decided back in the early 1970s that let's go to the private banking for our financial needs rather than relying on the public banks. So the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is owned by much and funded by and large by the World Monetary Fund, the Banking and International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, and the World Trade Organization, these guys basically control the world's financial elite. Now, when you have someone like Andrew Jackson, United States history, for that matter, President Lincoln, who said during the war down there, he said, I've got the South in front of me, I've got the international bankers behind me, I'm more concerned about the international bankers. Lincoln created the greenback, which is a government-based money which pay interest to yourself from the farmers, and he did quite well to fund his needs. And then when John F. Kennedy proposed to do the same thing, and unfortunately he was doing other things that people didn't like, well, he ended up dead. These individuals want to control world banking and control countries because Amschel Rothschild, the head of all this whole world banking scheme, has said this publicly. He said, I don't care. He said, give me control of the printing and circulation of the money of a country, and I don't care what puppet you put in place to control its legislation and its parliament, because he knows, as well as how we know that, and even how William Lyon Mackenzie King knew in Canada, that the control of a country is its sovereign control over the issuance of its credit and its monetary substance. And once they got control of that and switched us over to the private banking industry, we've lost, because now we no longer have control of our economics, and our government is hamstrung by being indebted to these people who will bail us out of problems for all these financial things that are coming at us, including us now. We're being faced right now with a $10.5 billion lawsuit against us because we are restricting selling water to California Sunbelt Corporation, and they're saying, well, you know, we have a right to take your water under NAFTA. So
yeah.
This is the craziness. We paid $10.5 billion for saying we want to protect our natural resources. They say we can't. And then that money we lose to pay could have been used to pay for our seniors' housing, could use to pay for all education for college and university students, which is a $3.7 billion a year price tag, and we could pay for all of our infrastructure for healthcare and otherwise. However, again, the corporate elite are taking over our country, and our parliamentary process is allowing it to happen, and there's no individual there outside the main parties which have been sucked up by this whole process who's speaking truth to power. That's why I've decided to run for leadership for the Canadian Action Party. That's why we need to get through those front doors of our Parliament Hill, and that's how we can finally become an independent voice that tells the truth, hears the truth, reports the truth, and stands up and asks these tough questions and all these issues, because it's a very simple thing. Why, has no one ever said, do we not borrow from ourselves and print our money like the Bank of Canada is supposed to do and not charge ourselves interest or pay ourselves interest? Why are we now borrowing money from private banking that gives interest to some foreign people or some foreign corporations? And I want to see, on behalf of the Canadian people, I want to see that individual who lives in Canada, who's got a Canadian flag tattooed to his forehead, who's collecting $114 billion each year from us and actually putting it back into our economy. He's not.
No. Andrew, you have a couple sites. One of your sites is www.justgetusin. Is that right?
We are pretty intent on getting ourselves in Ottawa. That's correct.
So at .ca or .com?
.com. So
.com.
Justgetusin.com is our run. Our federal election here in the area is October 14th. Yesterday we were in Temiskaming Shores, part of our riding up here, a beautiful area. I met the mayor up there, a lovely woman, who also sees that, you know, we are all trying our best at a municipal and community level to try to improve the situation we are all in, but we are hamstrung. We have no funds. We have no money. We have no infrastructure. We have no support. The money's tight. Well, the money's tight because our government's giving $114 billion a year away in taxes to people that are not Canadian. So Temiskaming Shores is a beautiful place. We met all the students at Temiskaming District High School. It was a fantastic experience. We felt very in touch, in tune with these students who are genuinely concerned for the welfare of not only their community, but the country as a large. The Just Get Us In website tells our story, what we're trying to do, all the issues we have to discuss. We cannot cover them all. As you can see, there's so much information to give that, and none of the major parties are talking about it. We want to talk about it. We want the country to be informed. And by the way, it's looking like for us is that we're going to make Temiskaming Shores our new home, and we're going to be we'll bring our natural health solutions up there, irrespective of what the government says, and we'll start curing people's diseases and let the rest of the world see we've done it there first. Because I cannot sit by as a physician and watch what's going on around us, or watch our country crumble, and watch us being sold out to the corporate interests at the behest of the needs and welfare of our seniors, of our future, our students, and of the infrastructure of the very fabric that makes our country strong and free.
Well, we're lucky to have courageous individuals like yourself, Andrew, out there, and with your medical background and the earnestness of your feeling, you know, we're in such a dire situation in our society and on the planet. We just have to have some sane people standing forward to try to take control back from the elements that have taken over our governments and society. It's an astonishing situation, the kind of wickedness that has crept in, permeated our society, you know. To see what we're doing, we're destroying a generation of children through the vaccination programs. They're being enforced now, universities, colleges, children, you know, it's really quite terrible.
It is horrible
to be facing this in the light of the craziness of these corporate elites.
But the same way, Dr. Holmes, we are poisoning our children, we are poisoning the environment. When you have President Bush leading a country of 300 million people who refuses to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, us as poor 30 million Canadians doing our best and looking at taxing ourselves for carbon emissions and trying to help the environment, we are just a drop in the bucket. When the 300 million people right next door to us who will not reduce their carbon emissions and play this environmental let's save the planet game, well then, what good can we do as individuals? But again, that's corporate directives directing the health and welfare of not only our here and now, but the future generations and the children, and the legacy we leave behind for the children and our grandchildren is going to be profound. And they're going to look back on us in the history of history and say that we were the most self-centered, egotistical, for-profit individuals that ever disgrace this planet and destroy this planet and ourselves in the name of a mighty dollar. It's not about being better than your fellow man. It's about helping your fellow man become better. And it's not about it's not about being better than your planet. It's about helping your planet become better. It's not about being better than anyone in your country. It's about helping your country be better. And if society would take upon those values that, you know, it's okay to profit, but not at everyone else's expense. I can profit, but still make sure I take care of the sick, the needy, the people who need homes and shelter and need health care. We can socialize our capitalism and do more good than harm. We won't do that when corporate interests are out there based entirely on profit at any expense and not have any care or concern about anything else in our environment or our people. And I am not going to lose one more day of sleep or one more tear on it. I'm just going to get it done. We don't need believers anymore. The believers aren't cutting it. We need doers. And the Canadian Action Party is full of doers, and I fully intend on leading this till this whole scenario stops, whether it takes me 40 years, 4 years, or 40 months. I don't know. But I'm not going to stop, and I'll do everything I possibly can to help our country and help our planet and help our citizens and stop this madness.
Thank you, Andrew. You have one other website. Do you still have your www.iamnetwork?
We have www.amassnetwork, AMASSnetwork.com.
You've got some excellent videos up there, and it goes all into the science of the vaccinations and a lot of wealth of material up on that website. So people, please check that out. And I'd like to thank you very, very much, Andrew, for your hours on the show, and good luck in your election and in your run for leadership. And
thank
I'm sure you'll be a figure that emerge on the Canadian stage.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, BBS Radio. Thanks, Doug.
And Andrew, I hope we can get you back, and we'll open up the phone lines.
Yeah. Wonderful. I'm on the Power Hour on Tuesday, October 7th, but I'd love to talk to the community. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
and you guys do a wonderful job there.
Okay. Thanks, BBS Radio.
Thank you, BBS Radio.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.